This is the Head Torch podcast. Welcome. Our mission, to create a mentally healthy culture at work. Keeping the conversations alive, our podcasts bring you great presenters and stimulating discussion on mental health and well-being in the workplace. Enjoy. Welcome in, everybody. Lovely to have you here with us for our Wellbeing Hour this month. I'm Amy McDonald.
And Angus Robinson.
And it's lovely to have you here. And of course, our special guest is Paul Sheeran, who I'll be introducing more formally shortly. And we also have our colleague Nick, who is beavering away in the background, making all things technical possible, which is great. So if you haven't realized already, we are recording this session. It's being recorded just for sound. So not for faces, but just for sound. So it means we can let the world know what we talked about here for forever, which is great. So for those of you that don't know us, we are Head Torch, and we do all things to enable organizations to develop and create a mentally healthy culture. So we work with every level within an organization, most senior team managers, frontline people. And it's all about, as I said, working to develop that mentally healthy culture. And we work with all kinds of organizations, large, small, public, private, international, local. It really doesn't matter, because as you know, mental health and well-being is relevant for each and every one of us. So welcome to this Wellbeing Hour. Let me just, first of all, give you a rundown of what we're going to be doing during the session. So first of all, I'm going to introduce our guest, Paul Sheeran, and then Paul will introduce himself using a mystery object. And then he and I will get into conversation. And so I'll be asking him all about his life and the importance of mental health, well-being, and so on in his working career. And then he's going to pose us all a question. So we'll have a chance to interact, open up your mic. Equally, you can put questions into the chat and we'll pick up on those as well. But it would be lovely to hear some other voices on this session too. And then Paul will share some of his top tips with us. And then that will be it. We'll be announcing what the next session will be and the next guest that we have coming up for you in June. So let me just share the screen with you and introduce Paul Sheeran to you. Paul is the chief exec at Scottish Engineering and has been since 2018. We first met Paul a few years ago now, right, Angus? When we did some work together with Scottish Engineering for their members. And since then, really, we have developed a very strong collaborative partnership, and so much so that we're delighted to be gold sponsoring their awards dinner, which is next Thursday night here in Glasgow. So we're really looking forward to being there with you, Paul. Amongst his glittering career, Paul has been managing director at Polaroid. He's been VP Global Operations of Polaroid's sunglasses business. And on top of all of that and his current duties, he is now acting as Dumbartonshire Area Team Chair for Young Enterprise Scotland, which he's been involved in for about 15 years or so. So a very warm welcome to you, Paul. If you'd now like to just share your mystery object and let us hear a little bit more about you from you.
Okay. Well, welcome, everyone. Thanks very much. As Amy said, I'm Paul Sheeran. My background has been in engineering, and I suppose I've picked this object. Let me just show you what the object is so you start guessing what it is. So it's an aluminium platen with a rubber with these holes, and I'll explain in a second. So I chose that one because I have been someone who engineering's always kind of been something I love since as long as I can remember. I famously, in my house when I was 8 years old, the first time I remember electrocuting myself because I took this switch apart in my bedroom to try and work out how it worked while the light was still on. I fixed bikes. I started helping my dad take engines out of cars and all that stuff when I was about 10. And so that's been a theme for me. I picked this one because it actually comes from a time quite nearish the start of my career, and it was actually a Polaroid. So what I just showed you is a platen separation block for making instant peel-apart film. And we had launched a product which, I'll be honest, it was successful commercially, selling really, really well, but it didn't want to get itself made. We'd spent a lot of money on automation equipment that frankly didn't work. Because it was a film product, all the machinery was in a dark room. You had to go in only using night vision goggles. It was hot, it was stuffy. We ran 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, because the demand for the product always outstripped what we could produce. We had people on really unpopular shift patterns, one of those 35-day rotating ones where you just always felt like you were on night shift forever. And it was tough. And it never stopped. And of course, I was in a sort of engineer managing role. And because it went so badly, I always felt like I had to be there. I ended up, it was probably one of those times in my life where I let work-life balance get massively out of balance. So I've kept that on my desk since about, I think, 1999, when we pulled the plug, because it was just so painful and not working. And I kept it. And I kept it as a reminder, not of a really terrible time, but as a reminder is that, you know, if you put your shoulder in, you can get through something, and there will always be a better day coming. I think I am generally if you want to be a happy person, you have to choose to be a happy person. So I look at that and think, well, I got through that. If I can live through that, I think I can live through most things. And so it's been on my desk ever since. So that's my mystery object for today. Full-on engineering tech stuff, I'm afraid.
Fantastic, Paul. That's brilliant. So it's not a domino then, no?
It's definitely.
As I first guessed. Brilliant. If you're not that familiar with Zoom, folks, top right-hand corner, you'll get speaker view. And you'll have Paul full view. So, Paul, tell us a little bit then. Let's hear about some of your career. You left uni 1990.
Did.
Way back then. Then what happened?
I left university in 1990. And it's important to say I left university. I didn't leave university with a degree in 1990. That didn't come till 1992. And I think it's important to, I think, some perspective on it. I went to join Sizewell B nuclear power station on the project team for that. I knew I wanted to do that because I'd worked in the north of Scotland in Dounreay on the fast reactor nuclear power development site there in the summers and done placements. I loved the industry. I loved the scale and size of the engineering. So I went off to work at Sizewell B as a control system engineer. I landed there, landed on my feet a bit, because I didn't have a degree yet, but I'd done programming at university. I kind of went down that route in my electrical electronic engineering degree. And believe it, you know, I had some French language skills. And so I landed on the job of managing the contract for the control system for Sizewell B. And engineers famously terrible at learning languages and doing that. So I ended up working with this company, Cegelec in France, to develop the software and the hardware for the control system for Sizewell B power station.
Wow. So it sounds like you were getting involved in something that excited you, and it was enabling you to travel and develop language as well. How exciting, fantastic.
And then they fell away because they were struggling to keep up with the contract. So a decision was taken to drop them. Contract was moved to Westinghouse in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. And now I was sitting in that position where I was prime candidate to go and be placed in Pittsburgh to try and catch back on the program and also learn the technology, learn the software and transfer it to the team back in the UK. So, yeah, great times. I think I was still only 23 when I went there, and it was just the most exciting thing in the world. I thought, wow, this is it. It's fabulous. I thought I've made it. And I say that after, because I wasn't a great student. I did not cover myself in glory with my academic prowess. I did finally get my degree, so there was a bit of resilience to do that. But I think, you know, it felt to me like I'd kind of landed and I was now on track on career. I had a degree, finally.
We all learn in different ways, don't we? So it sounds like you were getting more excitement and learning on the job, really.
I was, yeah, there's no doubt about that. I was well matched. You know, we all learn in different ways, but you're not going to learn much if you're lying in your bed.
talking of which, what was starting to happen to your sleep patterns at that early stage?
Yeah, so I once I started getting into the job, which was really quick, I would say within the first 2 months, I found that I thought it was something that I was good at, and more stuff came my way, and I was asked to get involved in different things. But what I didn't do very well with was managing the responsibility and pressure of that, and I turned it into a worrying thing. So I had no capability on switching off. So I'd leave the end of the workday with things, as always, which is normal workday, with things undone and things that had to be prioritized. And there were some tricky things in the contract, particularly around dropping the French and moving to the US team. But my sleep just went downhill, and it was something that I'd never thought about in my life. But I got into that pattern where I couldn't get to sleep at night. And I threw in coping mechanisms, which in hindsight were just papering over the cracks. So anybody who's ever done listening to a radio really quietly last thing at night just to get to sleep, or some of these other things, it got bad enough. I tried all of the essential oils, lavender oil on the soles of your feet, acupuncture in my face last thing at night to try and help me. And you look back at them and I understand now that they were, as I say, papering over the cracks. But the pattern went to hell in a handbasket 2, 3, 4 in the morning before falling asleep. And it wasn't a very healthy pattern.
Yeah. So what was it that was keeping you up?
Just that busy brain thing. And probably, honestly, a little bit of self-doubt. So the self-doubt coming from the, right, you haven't done that today and you really should have had that done and you've not resolved this problem here and what are you going to do about that? And, oh, no, here we go again. This is just like university all over again.
Yeah.
The internal dialogue, I think, that you strike up.
Mm-hmm. And then in the States, how did that work-life balance impact on you there?
So it wasn't too bad. Well, Westinghouse wasn't great. So Westinghouse, being placed there, they were a mandatory 6 days a week workplace. If you got in in the US, and apologies to any US colleagues who are on the call today, because it's always bad to kind of stereotype any. But I think there is a challenge in the US with working hours, and I think there's a challenge with presenteeism. It wasn't good form to be seen coming in after 6:30 in the morning, and it certainly wasn't good form to be seen leaving before 6 o'clock at night. Wow. As I say, Saturday mornings were mandatory, and it was the same. You know, 6:30 was the expectation.
And are we talking the 1990s here, or early 2000s, or?
So 1992, 1993 was when I was with Westinghouse. I went back. My wife and I went and lived and worked in the US in 1994, went to Michigan on the back of that kind of piece. Mm-hmm. But I ended up working for a much smaller kind of family-owned company. And I thought that that Westinghouse was not the greatest of balance, but working for a family-owned company in the US, it's a different level. Absolutely no qualms about phoning you on a Sunday night and saying you need to pack up, put your stuff in the car and drive to this plant. They've got a control system problem and you need to be there because they're going to be starting up tomorrow morning. So,
And in the meantime, was your sleep the same or had it?
Shocking. Absolutely.
Shocking. Right.
And now I was kind of adding some bad habits because the sort of, work-life balance thing coming from, you know, we were just always on. So it was, you're always on and you're always, you know, sort of expect to be on call.
Wow. And what was the wider impact for you at that time?
So I don't think I can overplay the wider impact too much, because I do think the bit that got me through it was, you know, I'm reasonably good at sort of brushing things and going, okay, well, it's a bit hard and it's a bit hard work here and stuff. I think the wider impact is lack of sleep's just really not good for you, and it's not good for your mood. And I think lack of sleep can lead to, when you're not at your best the next day, you can get into that habit of going, okay, here we go again. And it's because you're not sleeping because of this, and because you're not doing enough, and you're not getting things done quickly enough. So it's going to be a really negative cycle. And you can break it by getting some sleep back is the easy way, but it's easier said than done once you get in a bad sleep pattern. And once you get in some bad habits, it's really not good.
Yeah, absolutely. It sounds really tough. So, I'm not quite sure the line, but you're in Michigan and then you joined Polaroid in Nashville. Is that right?
Came back to Scotland, and managed to get a job with Polaroid. I kid you not, they were looking for a control system engineer who would be based in Scotland but could speak American, was their phrase. And I just got back from nearly 3 or 4 years of that. So, then the first project that they put me on was send me back to live in Nashville, Tennessee. And I had a great, great gig with Polaroid. I mean, I was in that cycle where, and I think it's one to watch, if you've got a slightly addictive personality, and I do think I do, then when things go well, you go, oh, I did well because I did that. So let's do more of that and more of that and more of that. And so you get in a bit of a cycle. But with Polaroid, I really reaped the rewards. I got moved through, you know, an engineer managing position, and then I was heading up a division, and then I was the engineer manager for the whole site, and then I was site director and then managing director, and then, you know, and then on to being a vice president of global operations for their eyewear business. So I really, you know, reaped the rewards of this kind of work cycle and work pattern. And I did really enjoy it, and lots of fabulous travel and lots of great people that I got to meet and work with around the world. But still, you know, a not great sleep pattern that was always there and something that I was just kind of coping around.
Mm-hmm. How do you think your colleagues at the time would describe the impact of your lack of sleep?
That's a great question, Amy. I have no idea. Like most people in that situation, I kid myself on that I hit it really well, but that won't be the case, will it? But you know, there's a great honest question I should ask some of them. That would be interesting to hear the answer. Yeah.
Grand. Well, so you were at Polaroid, things were going really well, and you had a great boss, didn't you, at Polaroid at the time?
I did. I had, so the chief executive officer of Polaroid at the time was a guy called Tom Bowden, and he was brilliant. He was great because he was a great coach. He didn't ever have much time because he had such a big role, but what he did with his time in terms of those conversations was really, really useful. It took a bit of getting used to it because, in the American phrase, he was really candid. But candid in the way was he didn't say things to hurt your feelings or make you feel bad. He said it because he wanted to help you. And he had some great things about, when you do these things, Paul, it's great and you should do more of them. And when you do these things, it's awful and you should not do those things.
So Blunt was his first name.
Blunt. And he identified something in me, which was, I don't know whether it's related or not, He said, look, you need to get hold of your temper. This short temper, this slightly aggressive, that's a lie, this aggressive stance that you can be in your default, it's not helping you. That's one of the things, when you do that, you should stop doing that. When you do all these other things, do them more, but this one's not working for you.
Wow. He said, how did that feel when he told you that?
Well, how do you think? I don't know. I think quite quickly, because the relationship with him was strong enough. But I think by the time I got home that night, I was going, Tom wouldn't have said that to me unless he really meant that that's something you're going to have to fix, or else you're not going to have the career that you want to have. So I think it was stung for the first, I don't know, 6 hours, but then a little bit of thinking time and I think it sunk in. And he turned around and said, look, I'm going to send you on this event, this 6-day residential event that I think you need. And some people, some senior people that I work with in that Polaroid have done. And it's called the Harold Bridger Working Conference. And I'm going to send you to that because I think it can help you.
Wow. So tell us about the conference. What happened?
So it came at a time when I was up to my neck in it. I was, I think, working flat out, not sleeping as usual, not very much. And so I was, and all the bad bits of me were going, what on earth is this for? 6 days. And it was 6 days, no laptop, 6 days, no phones, all that kind of stuff. They wanted your full attention. And there was no details for it. So I'm looking at it going, the engineer's mind and looking at it going, what's this all about? You know, where's the structure? What is it? You know, I'm expecting things broken down into 15-minute chunks for the day, and there's nothing like that. And it talks about we're going to examine the qualities that make a good leader. And then every now and again, we're going to stop and ask ourselves how we're doing with the task of examining the qualities that make a good leader. I'm looking at it going, that's so vague. Come on. So I went to it, you know, and it started on a Sunday. And I probably, you know, arrived skeptical and had all my skepticism confirmed within the first few minutes. The Harold Bridger thing is, he says, reasonably well known in those circles. It's called the two task method. And it was something that he came up with, they guinea pigged it with a bunch of other psychologists and to work this out. And it was about this self-development tool, which is the act of provoking conflict, if we're honest, by, you know, let's examine the qualities make a good leader, because we all have different opinions of that. And then the real killer bit of stopping every now and going, how are we doing as a group? So I went into that. I sat there fuming. The first day, we did a full day of, for me, just utter nonsense, just staring at our belly buttons. And we sat down at the end of the day, and the leader of the working conference said, we're going to pause now and open the floor to thoughts about our learnings of today. And I'm sitting there going, well, I've learned nothing. I've wasted the day. I could have been working. I could have been doing stuff. And not only that, but nobody said anything. And nobody said anything for what me felt a long time. Well, I know how long it was because I timed it. It's 4.5 minutes. 4.5 minutes, a long, long time when you're waiting for something to happen. And then somebody opened his mouth, and it was one of the psychologists, and said, I feel like my mind has expanded to fill the room and now includes the birds flying outside the windows.
Fantastic. And how did you react to that?
Well, if I could have been a cartoon character, my head would have exploded.
So how did it continue on then for the rest of the week?
So I think by Monday afternoon, I made my attempt at a coup to take over. We were all in individual working groups, and I came back and I said, all right, come on. I don't know about you lot, but this isn't working for me. We've got no structure. We've got no order. We've got no nothing. Oh, and by the way, I think we need a leader. And if nobody else is willing to do it, I'll do it. And I got, you know, in psychological terms, just an absolute kicking for the next 2 hours. Absolutely. And rightly so, every bit deserved. And so then I did, and it was strong enough that I did about a day of listening. Wow. Not speaking, and not in a huff or anything. I'm genuinely just listening and processing. And then
how was that?
Interesting, not usual for me. I think the next day I started interacting, and then Thursday evening, after a full day of this, and it was a sunny day. And
what, so you've been there Sunday to Thursday by that time?
Thursday went up to the biggest conference room, and they always opened it, the phrase the same one. We'll now review the learnings of today. And instead of looking at my watch, I started thinking about what I'd felt and learned and seen in the last week. And I didn't look, you know, not looking at my watch. So I'm just thinking about that. And I had this idea that like lots of confusing things, like dust particles in the air. And some of that would probably because of the sunlight coming in the windows. But then I had this idea about them clumping together into sort of more sort of valid thoughts and more sort of useful kind of directions. And then the thoughts started flying around the room around me. And it was the first time, I think, in my life where I ever got into something approaching a sort of meditative state. That's what came from those days. And it was a really, really excellent experience because it was, I don't think I'd ever felt anything as calming in my life.
Wow. So if you could sum up what you took away from that whole experience, what would it be?
So I arrived as a horrible skeptic. I had a light bulb moment. Not just that one sitting there, was over the course of the days. And what that did for me was it opened the door to, we need to get an understanding of what your mind can do for you and what and how much it's malleable, how much it can be controlled. And it was sort of a gateway into some other things. I became a real fan of neuro-linguistic programming. Did a bit of mindfulness, which I still do now. And the big thing that came from it was that realization that you can control your mind more than you think you can. And the NLP particularly helped me understand that, you know, I wasn't sleeping because I wasn't getting control of that thinking pattern. And whether I know some people, NLP is a blunt tool and it uses some crude kind of analogies but the idea of separating out the understanding of your conscious and your subconscious, so I like this idea that your conscious is the world's nastiest, cheapest 50 pence calculator. It does plus, minus, subtraction and division, and that's it. It's the input output. And your subconscious is the world's most powerful supercomputer. It can do anything you want it to, but the problem is it's programmed with your conscious, or it's mucked up by your conscious. So, you know, the great example there is, you know, anybody who's run around their house trying to find their car keys, going, oh, I can't find them again, I can't find them. Well, somebody will have moved them. And, you know, that was explained to me is that's your conscious telling your subconscious, we don't want to find the car keys. And your subconscious going, that's fine, we don't need to find the car keys. I don't want them. And the minute something happens, like the doorbell rings and stops your conscious, so it's like the dumbest thing. It goes, oh, doorbell, doorbell, doorbell. And your subconscious goes, that's the keys over there. Oh, right, sitting right in front of my face. So, you know, that was a real, okay, because that's happened to me. And then from there, it was building up techniques to say, right, how am I going to stop this monkey mind running around throwing mud at me and when I want to go to sleep? How am I going to get that under control? And I used mindfulness technique, just a straight breathing exercise, you know, that folks that do yoga will know well as doing that, and a bit of a swish method that just keeps saying anything that comes popping in, I just say, I know you're important. I'll deal with you tomorrow. I'm not dealing with you just now. And you have to practice and you have to keep your practice up if it's going to work for you. But it does. And yeah, it's enabled a kind of different way of thinking about how you communicate with people, how you put yourself in their shoes if you really want to communicate with them, and a bunch of stuff like that.
Fantastic. That's amazing. Thank you so much for sharing your story, Paul. That's absolutely brilliant. So how long now has your sleep been improved?
So I think it took about a year after the Harold Bridger, because I went and found the first NLP course myself. I went and did that literally within 4 weeks of doing NLP. I've never looked back, and sleep's not been an issue for me since.
Wow. But it was that significant moment at Harold Bridger that was the beginning, if you like, of that journey.
I definitely, you know, that whole process of arriving as a skeptic, being true to myself, which was I'm going to take over the world, and not in a nice way, and then getting the crap kicked out of me verbally. That was the enabler.
That was the enabler, yeah, that's right. Often we need to fall to find the right place, right? when we stand up again, to help us stand up again in a different way. Great. Well, you have a question that you'd like to share with all of us. I'm just going to share that on the screen with you now. So, Paul, would you like to share this question?
Yeah, so one of the things that's come from getting a better handle on that is understanding, you know, a few alarm signals that warns me that my mood is slipping and it needs attention. And I'd love to hear from others what theirs are. And I think it could be useful for us all.
Yeah, great. So if you would like to share your thoughts with us on this question and or ask Paul any other questions, please, if you could use the reaction symbol, we can and then you can unmute and we'll hear your question. And we'll put that question there it's in the chat already for you, just to remind you of our question. Jennifer McDonald, yes. Would you like to unmute yourself? Are you Jennifer or Jenny?
I am Jennifer or Jen. Hi, Paul. Great. Thank you for that.
Jennifer, could you just tell us what organisation you work with, first of all?
Of course. I work for NMIS, the National Manufacturing Institute of Scotland, and I am the new diversity manager, previously an engineer. So shift patterns, night shift, done all that. My question to you is, do you think if you'd had control over your sleep or the sleep systems you had when you were younger, would you have been as successful or more successful or less successful depending on the kind of environment you were in?
Thanks, Jennifer. So I think the sleep patterns were just a part of the overall. So if you look at the Harold Bridger conference, so the Harold Bridger conference opened the door to me to fixing my sleep pattern. But the other thing that it did was it gave Tom Bowden what he wanted, which was I got a handle on, you know, that bit of the aggression and conflict, you know, and realized I was never going to bring people with me by doing that. It was the conflict within that. Within the Harold Bridger Working Conference that I saw firsthand that I initiated was such a learning moment because it was painful, really painful. But also what was useful about it was over the days, you saw why it was so personally hurtful to the people who I was working with and what I did. And I think what you don't get in the workplace is things happen, you know, and you know, maybe you apologize, maybe you discuss it out for 15, 20 minutes and then you walk away. We're literally locked in a room with these same people for the next, 5 days after that incident. And what you get from that is you really understand why people reacted to that in that way. And you get to ask yourself, do you want to be like that? Is that the kind of person you want to be? Do you really want to be hurtful? I don't think there's anything that's easier to help you change your behaviours than that kind of that understanding. And I think the only thing is we often in life, we just don't have time to get to that level of understanding. And that was the great thing about that situation.
Thank you.
Wow. Fantastic. Do we have another question or thoughts on the question? Don't be shy.
Ask the question. Amy, is it okay if I talk? Because I asked the question because it definitely for me is I've got some markers that are irritability and being short with people is the first sign for me that I am drifting away, and what I know will fall from it if I don't do something about it is a down cycle in my mood, and I'm wary enough of that to watch out for it and pull back up.
Mm-hmm. I'm interested in
we've got a comment there
the correlation between I'm interested in the correlation between...
Jim, I might have to wait for four
Sorry,
and a half minutes.
Angus, could you just mute yourself? There we go. Sorry about that. Yeah, I'm interested in the correlation between that irritability and sleep.
Yeah, so, and I see, hi, Sandra Mulligan, broken sleep is the signal for me. The irritability, I think, comes to when you start getting annoyed with yourself, it becomes harder then at night to switch off and say, right, this is sleep time. Because for me, having had that experience, when I'm irritable and I'm unfair with people during the day, the raking the coals of, why are you doing that again? Why are we back to this? Why are we, here we go again. Back to our old bad ways and bad behaviors. I think that becomes the trigger for, it's much harder to switch off from that. It's much harder to switch off and go, that wasn't, you've acted in that unfair way today. Mm-hmm. And it's much harder to just go, okay, I'll deal with you tomorrow. Because it's not deal with you tomorrow, it's what you did today. And mm-hmm. I think you can have just that eternal review of, why are we back to this? Why are we back to this? So right, that's the signal and the worry to watch out for.
It's about stilling the mind, isn't it? Absolutely about stilling the mind. I'm dipping into a book at the moment called Chatter by Ethan Cross. Have you come across that? He's an American academic. Cross is Kross, and it's really very interesting around how lots of different methods, but also kind of the background to why we chatter and all that kind of stuff. I'd recommend it. I've got a few comments coming in here now in the chat. Sandra, do you want to share a little bit of your thinking? Broken sleep is the signal for me. Do you want to share a little bit about that?
Hi, Amy. Yes, hi. Thanks very much. And thanks very much, Paul.
Yeah, sorry. Do you want to tell us also which organisation are you calling in from?
Oh, sorry. Hi, I'm Sandra Mulligan, and I work as a business development manager with the Institution of Mechanical Engineers. So I'm based in Glasgow, and pre-COVID worked with members in Glasgow and Scotland, but post-COVID is working with members globally, really. So, I've had to change my work pattern from somebody who's out and about meeting people all the time to somebody who's at home doing presentations via Teams like this all the time, with people not having cameras on, not contributing, etc. But I've certainly noticed that, for me, I'm naturally a sort of worrier. I'm the eldest of eight children, so I've always been the very sort of responsible person in the family. Mm-hmm. And I tend to put my needs last as a result. So I find I get very, very busy. And unless I make the time to, try and get a walk and some fresh air during the day, try and do something to relax at night, be that, play a little bit of tennis or have a bath or whatever, I will be able to get to sleep fine. But then I'll be awake 2, 3, 4 o'clock in the morning, mulling over work stuff and stuff that's bothering me and not able to get back to sleep, and then going around like a zombie the next day. So for me, that's a signal that, okay, I need to review what I'm doing and make a little bit of time for myself so that I can actually relax, because I think getting good sleep is really, really important.
Yeah, it's so important. I think it's, for me, just butting in here, Paul, sorry, it's for you, but for me, it's about, so much of how we sleep is about what we do during the day.
Yes. Right? Yeah,
there's a direct link, isn't there? Yeah.
And important thing I just wanted to mention was, Paul has reminded me of years ago, I did a course with Mindstore, Jack Black, all about the power of your subconscious mind. Mm-hmm. And that was excellent and fantastic. And I really enjoyed it. And needless to say, over the years, I've totally forgotten about it. So, Paul, that's a really good reminder for me to actually go back and review some of that and try and put it into practice again. But thank you very much, though, for sharing your story with us today. That's really, really inspiring. Thank you.
Lovely. Paul, what are your thoughts?
I think it's really useful to see, the common themes. So Alison, irritability does it for me, skipping meals, not finding the time for a nice path. That you're headed down a rut. And Ginny had said, one of the signals, but also mentioned, start to feel frustrated and blaming others. I think that's a brilliant one, Ginny. I think when you get to the stage where you're looking for who else to blame other than yourself, you know, it's like ding, 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 ding.
So it's important, isn't it, that people can point out to you if you're unwell, you know, if you're if you are becoming irritable. Miles Keane, would you like to share your question? I'll share first of all which organisation you're with, Miles. Good to see you.
Oh, yeah, I'm Miles Keane. I'm from Coutts, the private bank, so work down in London. But I think, Paul, I think we met at Gogaburn a few years ago on at a conference. But no, I think your points are really a really good one, because, you know, knowing your triggers and knowing the signs and actually doing something about it, because I'm having, thankfully, my mental health concerns were quite in the past now, but I just totally ignored those sort of early warning signs, and that's really important to be aware of them. And like a lot of the people who've spoken today, the sleep was a real driver. But I think the other thing was sort of just physical things, like sort of teeth clenching and, I don't know, the odd sort of, you just feeling tense and just sort of things spinning around in your head. And I think the thing that I've learned is, you know, there's a few people that sort of, you know, give yourself a rating of where you are on the anxiety scale, and just doing that every now and then actually, if you've had a bad day, think about what might have driven that. Is it as bad as you think? You really test why you think it's a bad day, because, you know, a lot of things don't actually materialize to the thought that you think they will do. And actually anchoring that point, and then rather than worrying about it and letting it spin around your head, is just thinking things through and just sort of setting aside some time. You know, don't carry it around in your head, because that's just so exhausting. But when you've got a proper thing to deal with, is just allocating some time and actually taking a sort of a measured, in control approach to it, rather than sort of, you know, boosting the anxiety. But it's interesting. I'm quite good now under pressure, but what's really important for me when I've got a lot on is to not ignore those going for the walks or going to the gym or going for a run. And I find that when I do get stressed and I look back, it's often I've forgotten to do some of those really important building blocks that just keep your resilience very steady. Because, you know, I think that out of everything that I've learned, just getting fresh air and being exercising, no matter what you might not have to be a gym person, but, you know, just building that in as part of your everyday routine is so important. And I think it was really difficult during lockdown that people couldn't do that, you know, the whole distraction, because A, it keeps you fit, but B, it's just a distraction from all the stuff that's going on.
Thanks, Miles. No, thank you. What do you got any thoughts on that, Paul?
Yeah, no, I think that's I can't agree more. I think looking for those triggers and the ones that are particularly individual and personal to you. There's a whole thing about this that and I go back to the NLP, that the best thing about it was this about being honest with yourself. And that I think that's all about these personal triggers. To get to them, to understand what they are, you have to be really honest. So the blaming, a lot of people, and I've mentioned about the blaming others, and so Fleur has put something in there.
Yeah.
Getting to the point where you go, oh, I'm blaming others, which really means, you know, stop and have a look at yourself. I think is really important one, that one.
Absolutely, yeah. And it's vital, like Miles is saying, to fresh air and exercise works for most of us, but it's about finding what works for you, right? That's the most important thing. Great. Well, thank you for sharing your comments, folks, and asking some questions. So Paul's got a few top tips for us now. So we'll just we'll hear some of them. So this is your first one, which we were just talking about there, Paul.
Absolutely. So number one, I know that my mood will go if I go away from this one. So making room for exercise. And I am no athlete. I'm a plodder, but it's really important to me to do that.
Yeah.
So I think this one, it does take a bit of time and it's investment. That pre being forced to go to the Harold Bridger conference, I would have went, yeah, sounds really interesting, but I'm too busy for that. And I think that's a fault we can all fall into and still do. But investing time and understanding how your and other minds work is a key.
Yeah. And that goes into things like, if it is mindfulness for you, then that would be something that taps in. But it's finding what works for you, isn't it? Because I mean, personally, I do art, and I know that I go into that space, you know, and just kind of listen. It's about listening to yourself, isn't it? And being able to tap into that, finding that space.
Yeah, I think that this area is a whole overlapping Venn diagram, you know, all these things, you know, yoga and mindfulness, psychology, the science of communication, personal excellence, neuro-linguistic program, they all kind of have an overlapping bit at the center. They're different in some ways, but there's cores at the heart of them which are the same.
Yeah, absolutely. Practice the techniques that allow you to worry about the things you can control and not the ones you can't.
Yeah, I think this one was a really key for me, is that sorting out in your head is like, am I going around in circles on something I can't do anything about either ever or today? Mm-hmm. And it's really helpful. And again, it's one that's practicing that to the point where you go, oh, I can't ever do anything about you. Okay, I swish you away and off to the side. You might come back, but I'm just going to swish you away. Or the other ones, which is, I do need to do something about you. I can't do anything about you now. It's 11 o'clock at night and I need to go to sleep. So pushing that aside and saying, you know, I can't control you now. So I'll come back to you tomorrow, but you're off you go and out of the way. And it, you know, practicing it is the tricky, because you learn it and you go, oh, great, good, got that sorted. And then you tail off, and that's my own personal story. And then you go, right, okay, let's get back on that and make sure that we don't do that again.
Mm. So it's going back to actually, you have control over the thoughts that are taking you to things that you don't have control over. So it's saying, I don't need to think about that thing that I don't have control over. I have control over that.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. So if you agree that the only thing you get from conflict is more conflict, program your brain to insert pause now. Lovely.
So that's lifted straight off of Gordon Robb NLP training, which is, you know, understanding that the worst thing you can do is they open your mouth and go. When you've got this, you know, collection of preformed model prejudices, all your biases, all your everything that's sitting in your brain, you know, that you'll hate yourself for later, you know. And even if it's just responding to conflict with conflict, well, you're not so clever yourself, you know, that childish playground stuff, you know, just to stop and pause. And then the next thing after pausing is to put yourself in the other person's shoes and go, what have I done? How am I acting that they are coming to me with conflict? Or what are they worried about that makes them that you know, to behave in this way? If I can try and stop and take a pause and understand that, I'll have more chance of then actually communicating with them, understanding and finding some common ground. But how many times in our life you look back and you go, yeah, you know, I talk to myself, sometimes you just got to stand up for yourself, and the only thing you get from it is more conflict, and it just runs on and on and on. And getting a handle on, you know, there's no good ever comes from that. You only ever get more conflict from conflict. There are very few times in life where you have to stand up for yourself, and you know, on the greatest scale, you know, what's happening in the Ukraine is one of them. But in our lives, there's not very many of them where, you know, this diffusing or finding a way around conflict isn't the right path.
Yeah, it's so much, isn't it? I love what you're saying there about putting yourself in the other person's shoes, you know, pressing that pause and putting yourself in the other person's shoes. It's such a powerful experience in and of itself, isn't it? And I, you know, I'm sure, you know, most people have sent an email that they have regretted. It's nothing better, is it, than writing an email and putting it in draft before you send it. Can be so helpful. Yeah.
You know, there was there was one that really got my mind on that one, which was when we were doing the session. So the aggression, the kind of front footed, you know, not nice stuff. I was also an aggressive driver, but you know, mm-hmm. I remember in one of the NLP sessions, one of the examples they gave about put yourself in the other person's shoes is, the next time you're behind, you know, somebody, or somebody wants to come and cut in on you, or they're driving really slowly in front of you, in your mind, they are incompetent, they can't drive for toffee, they're rude, they're pushing their way in. Think about this. Think about the person in front of you that's slow and is slowing you down and holding you up. Imagine they're your parents, or elderly, just trying to get somewhere, confused, worried, nervous about it. And think about how you want other people to treat them. Or the person who comes up on the inside, you know, and wants to get into the queue of traffic. Yeah, they may just be trying to steal a little march, but maybe they're trying to get somewhere to see someone that they need to go and see. Maybe they're trying to get to the hospital. Maybe they've got something, you know, really important in their life. You know, you don't know that. And you know what? Which side do you want to fall on? You fall on the side of maybe there's some real good reason why they have to do that. Or, you know, put themselves in your shoes and take the view of, you know, that's why it might be important for them to be doing what they're doing just now. And I think that's usually useful, and it won't be true all the time, but the other one won't be true either. Oh, look at this behavior again. That's ridiculous.
Yeah,
I'll just inch forward a little bit and make sure they don't get in.
Thanks, Paul.
Sorry.
And your final tip, no, that's great. And your final tip, being honest with yourself about where your mental health has been in the past will help you look after it in the present. Wow, how true. Fantastic. So, Paul, I'd just like to finish by asking you a few quick fire questions. Ladies and gentlemen, he knows nothing what's coming to him. So here goes. Quick fire. So quick response, we'll move on to the next one. Your first question is, what does vulnerability mean to you?
I'm a Brené Brown fan, so I hear that and say shame.
Okay. And if you notice someone struggling, what's the first thing you would do?
So if you're engaging with them, I've heard that trying to make your question start with what is less judgmental and can be more helpful.
And what message would you give to your younger self?
Oh, I don't think we have time to answer that one.
What message would you give to other people who are having difficulty sleeping?
Oh, so no, the message I would give to my younger self and anybody else is get a handle on this stuff earlier. Don't wait till you're in your mid-30s for me before you get it sorted out. And I think our younger generation are much, much better shape than mine ever were in terms of getting your head around the big picture things in life. But that would be my advice. Understand this stuff. Not just for the sleep. I think if you maybe would have gone near the sleep if you'd have done this. For me, I'd be teaching NLP and psychology in school. I think it's a skill for life.
Skill for life. Yeah. I think the thing is, all our emotions are a call to action, right? But we can spend an awful lot of time ignoring them. And actually, it's when we start listening to them that things start to be easier for us, I think. Often. Yeah, lovely. If you could wave a magic wand, Paul, at every workplace, in terms of mental health, what would you make happen?
Oh, well, I suppose very trite, but if wave the magic wand and make people be kind to each other, because I think the kindness at the heart of it is it would take away the prejudice, the bias, the belittling, the marginalization. Yeah, be kind to people.
Fantastic. What a great message to end on there. Thank you very much. I'm just going to ask Angus to come in now. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Paul. Wow, what a journey. I've known you for quite a number of years now, and it had never once crossed my mind that you could have been aggressive or somebody who, you know, created conflict. It's never even crossed my mind. So thank you for your very frank and honest talk. You know, it was fascinating, actually. And you know, some of the big messages, having the time to get a level of understanding about yourself, Yeah. And how, you know, how true that is, and open the door to what your mind can do for you. Yeah. And I really, really like that. As well as, of course, prioritizing what keeps you well and that exercise and all that type of thing. And insert the pause now. Yeah, great message here. Also, getting the crap kicked out of you was the enabler for all this.
I'm not sure that's the greatest of messages, is it?
No, but you know, it just shows, you know, sometimes where we have to go, yeah, to, you know, to reach that enlightenment, if you like. So, yeah, fascinating. Thank you very much, Paul. You know, we love working with you guys at Scottish Engineering, and that was really, really good. Thank you. Next month, on the 16th of June at 12 noon, we have Nazia Mahmood. Nazia is an Earth Intelligence Sales Engineer. How's that for a title, a job title? She is also chairperson of the Scottish Government's Equality and Wellbeing Manufacturing Group. So it promises to be really, really interesting. I'm looking forward to that. Please come and join us. And also get in touch with us if there's anything that we can help you with. We work with all levels of organized and in an organization. And do things like follow us on LinkedIn, keep an eye out for things that are coming out like this. And, you know, it'd be a great pleasure to see you all here again. Great. Unless there is any other questions, we will wrap up and go and have our lunches.
I just want to say thanks, everyone, for putting your comments in the chat. I know we didn't manage to read it all. If you know, I hope you've had a chance to have a glance at what people have been writing, because there's certainly some lots of great comments in there that we didn't manage to get to all of them. But thank you. Thank you again, Paul. Thank you, everyone, for coming.
Thank you, everybody.